Welcome to Seminars at Steamboat, lectures on important public policy issues recorded at the Strings Music Pavilion in Steamboat Springs, Colorado. The following seminar features President and CEO of the Eno Center for Transportation, Robert Puentes, giving a lecture titled The Road Ahead for Autonomous Vehicles. You'll find a full extended question and answer session from the seminar at kunc.org. Seminars at Steamboat board member Walt Dabbert introduced Puentes at the event, which was recorded on July 30th.
In introducing this evening's speaker, I'd like to step back a minute and share with you some remarks concerning a classic book called Crossing the Chasm, written by Geoffrey Moore in 1991. And among other topics in this now classic text, it addresses the technology adoption life cycle and the chasm, or the valley of death, as others have called it, and I think lately some are calling it about autonomous vehicles. But in my very simplistic view, the chasm is a gap. It's a sort of no man's land where the objective is merely to cross over to the other side and begin making a profitable product. But it's actually a do-or-die space that separates the many innovative technologies that fall by the wayside from those very few products that transition first through the tornado phase and ultimately onto Main Street. There are many barriers that need to be surmounted to successfully cross the chasm. These include technical, social, financial, and public policy issues. And in view of tonight's presentation, it was rather prescient that the preface to the 1991 edition of Crossing the Chasm addressed the challenges at that time of the introduction and acceptance of a then disruptive automotive technology, the electric vehicle. So it's only fitting that this evening's seminar will lay out, pun intended, the road ahead and the many speed bumps and potholes along the way for autonomous vehicles, especially those that pertain to matters of policy. I am very pleased to introduce our speaker, Robert Puentes, and welcome Robert and his wife, Jeannie, to Steamboat and to seminars. Robert is president and CEO of the Eno Center for Transportation, a nonprofit think tank with the mission to improve transportation policy and leadership. Robert previously served as director of infrastructure programs at the Intelligent Transportation Society of America. Prior to joining Eno, he was a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution's Metropolitan Policy Program, and he is currently also a non-resident senior fellow with Brookings. With that, please join me in giving a warm welcome to Robert Puentes.
Thanks very much. Appreciate that. Good afternoon. Good evening, everybody. Good evening? I guess it's evening. Thanks very much for the really nice introduction. I really appreciate that, Walt. And thank you, Bob and Belle and the whole team for bringing me out here. This is the first time I prepared for a speech by taking a dip in a geothermal hot spring. So I'm really, really relaxed right now. I'm also relaxed because I'm not in Washington. And, you know, we're based in Washington. We do a lot of work with federal Washington, but we do work in cities and suburbs all across the United States. And so it's good to be actually outside of that federal conversation that's happening now, because Washington, it's not a political statement, it's not a very healthy place right now. So it's great to be out in the real world where people are doing real things. And it's also not 97 degrees and 90% humidity. So I'm glad to be here. And I'm glad to be here talking about transportation things and specifically talking about this intersection between autonomous vehicles and public policy. And I was told that it was okay to talk about policy. This is a sharp group. I didn't have to kind of de-wonk anything. So we're definitely going to get into some of the policy discussions. But I'm really happy because looking at the lineup of speakers that you've had at these seminars over the years, it's really obviously a very impressive group of people tackling quite literally the most important issues of our time. You're talking about North Korea and healthcare. These have all been recent issues you've been talking about here. So having transportation part of that discussion, I think it's fantastic. I really want to thank the board for pulling that together. Because as we think about transportation, as we think about everything that's going on in this country now, it's a very dynamic time in our country's history. Therefore, it's going to be a dynamic time in transportation. Because transportation is derivative of all those big things that are happening. As transportation people, we say, you know, transportation is a means to an end. It's not the end in and of itself. We have to keep remembering that and thinking about that with transportation, because that's really how it should be situated. Because despite the frustrations I think that a lot of us have with things like crumbling infrastructure, that's big in the news today, despite the challenges with things like connecting people to jobs and economic opportunity, we'll talk a little bit about that, despite the problems with things like greenhouse gas emissions and the role that transportation has in that, transportation is the number one emitter of greenhouse gases by sector, and despite the political nonsense that's happening in Washington and a lot of other places across the country, there is so much innovation and interesting things that are happening in transportation right now. New kinds of partnerships, new kinds of policies, and really a new kind of problem solving to try to get things done. So the way that we thought about transportation in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, that model has been thrown out, and there's all kinds of new people that are involved in getting things done. So again, really, really interesting time to be doing this. And so in my time at the Eno Center, I've been there for about 3 years now, no other issue has dominated the discussion like the conversation around autonomous vehicles. I'll probably say AVs. Every once in a while, I'll slip into acronym mode. I apologize for that. I'll try to keep the acronyms to a minimum, but AVs are the shorthand way for talking about autonomous vehicles. But no other issue has really dominated as much as this one, because all over the country, all across the world, governments are under pressure to both craft regulations that stimulate innovation, be those good actors that helps the innovation promulgate, but also making sure that we're adhering to a range of public policy goals and objectives. So all of that is being smashed together right now, and it's all being churned out, and it's a really interesting time. The number one takeaway I'm going to leave you with now is we don't know what's going to happen. It's such a different time. We know what the technology is supposed to be doing. We know what policy is supposed to be doing. But all of that is getting mixed up right about now. In fact, I'll give you a quick anecdote. They had a major conference in Washington, not federal Washington, but the city of Washington a few months ago. They brought in business leaders, civic leaders, scientists from Argonne National Labs, all these really smart people to figure out what is the impact of AVs, of autonomous vehicles, going to be on the Washington metropolitan area. Let's go forward 30, 40 years. What's it going to look like? And they came out after 2 days and they said, well, we don't know. We really don't know. When it comes to just greenhouse gas emissions, they said we can either see a reduction of 90% in greenhouse gas emissions or an increase in 200%. That's the range that we're working with here. So my overarching point is there's a lot we don't know, but this is not a time to wait. A lot of communities, a lot of places can start to craft the places that they want and the role that autonomous vehicles has in all of that. So I am not a skeptic about autonomous vehicles, nor am I an evangelist, but just trying to lay out kind of the situation best as I can see it right now. So let me just start then with a quick commercial about the Eno Center for Transportation. So the Eno Center is a Washington-based think tank. We're about 100 years old. Eno is not an acronym for anything. It's actually somebody's name, Mr. William Phelps Eno. He invented the stop sign. He invented the roundabout. He did the roundabout in Columbus Circle in New York City, the Arc de Triomphe in Paris. Basically, he was living at a time when automobiles were starting to take over these city streets. Cars, horses, buggies, all the trolleys were all interacting with one another. So he set out to lay out the first rules of the road. Drive on the right side, stop at this thing. That's kind of what he started to do. So 100 years later, we're actually at that same kind of phase right now, figuring out what are the new rules of the road going to be for autonomous vehicles. We're the only think tank, though, that's focused on all modes of transportation, not just AVs. We do aviation, everything else down to electric scooters. We go up and down the Federalist chain. As I said, we're based in Washington, but we do work all across the country, and we do it with a whole range of public, private, and nonprofit sectors, because that's where the new action is. That's how things are getting done today. We're a think tank, so we do reports. We do them from lots of different sectors, as I have up here. But a couple of things focused specifically on autonomous vehicles. The last one we just did was called Beyond Speculation, because we are past that now. We're past speculating whether or not these things are coming, whether or not things are happening. They're clearly happening, so we're beyond that right now. The plan is to figure out how do you want your place to look in the light of these things. Next slide, please. And all of this matters because people got really excited recently with reports of this automated van driving in the streets of Arlington, Virginia, just outside of Washington. This is not on some kind of closed testing ground, but navigating through the streets of a very dense area, one of the oldest street grids, a very complex environment. You can see the LiDAR, you can see all this stuff. It made sense. Virginia is a leader in trying to promote autonomous vehicle testing and things like that, but we hadn't seen anything like this in a long time. Everybody got very excited. Come to find out, it's this guy, testing an autonomous vehicle. So the point I'm trying to make here is that it wasn't an autonomous vehicle at all. It was this guy dressed up like a car seat. This is actually a researcher at Virginia Tech. They were trying to research exactly the thing that we were wondering about. How do people interact in an environment like this? This is also my Halloween costume forever from now on. So, but the point is, while there's a ton of hype about autonomous vehicles right now, we really need to be careful and not get out in front of ourselves, because there are still things like this going on. The hype is actually understandable, because the promise of autonomous vehicles really is enormous. Go ahead and give it a click. In terms of safety, right now, we know that there are about 40,000 people that die each year on the American roadways. About 90% of those crashes are the result of human error. And you've seen these stats. It's like 3 Boeing 777s going down every single day. That's the math. Even if that was once a week, people would probably do something about it. But the promise for AVs is that it would almost virtually eliminate those kinds of problems that are the result of human error. Traffic congestion. We waste over $300 billion each year sitting in traffic, cumulative across the country. Because AVs are designed to operate close together, because they can predict some of these things, their promise is that AVs will actually start to make a dent in traffic congestion. As you all know here and other places, we haven't really been able to do that with the way that we think about transportation for other things. Household costs. Transportation is the number 2 household cost just after housing. Most of that is going towards vehicle purchases, insurance, just having a vehicle. There's plans for autonomous vehicles where it might be shared vehicles. You might be able to call up a vehicle on your app and pay for mobility as a service, just like you do with Netflix or anything else like that, dramatically making a reduction in the amount of money that households spend on vehicles. And then possibly the best thing it can do is create access. When we think about transportation, as I said at the beginning, it's really about what transportation is designed to do. Transportation connects people to jobs and economic opportunity, especially for people in poverty. There's a famous Harvard study showing that the number 1 way to get people out of poverty is to reduce their commute times. They studied all these different things, and commute times was the number 1 thing. So the point is, if people are in close proximity to jobs and economic opportunity, that's going to do a lot to get them out of poverty. But beyond just the poor, we have elderly being isolated. We have a senior tsunami coming up. The promise of autonomous vehicles to continue to provide that kind of mobility and access to people as they age is really something that is certainly could be transformational. So given the promise and given all the hype, it's not surprising that the market for AV driving systems is going to grow quite a bit over the next 20 years. So with this much money at stake, you can see why there's a lot of hype, there's a lot of pressure, a lot of this coming from consultants and advisors and private sector folks, things like that. But this is all kind of focused on the hype that we're facing right now. So what we're looking at here then is what analysts are calling the heaven and hell scenarios, or the utopia and the dystopia for autonomous vehicles. Heaven, of course, is where we have vehicles that are parts of shared fleets that we're seeing today with car share, bike share, things like that. Virtual elimination of traffic accidents, as I said, that's obviously a heaven scenario. Lower car emissions or lower carbon emissions from cars, if we're moving towards electric vehicles, things like that. If we have fewer parking lots, better use of the infrastructure, less traffic congestion, economic growth and productivity that expands all areas of society so everybody gets to benefit. That's obviously the heaven scenario. That's what a lot of folks will tell you is the promise of autonomous vehicles, and they may not be far off. The hell, of course, is if these are private vehicles, if we see a decline in infrastructure quality because they're not paying money that we can invest back in the roadways, we might have greater carbon emissions if these are not electric vehicles, if they're just circling blocks waiting for people to be picked up. Roadways could become parking lots. We might see a huge increase in driving. It might only be focused on certain segments of the population, and then we might be eliminating certain jobs in other cases. That's the hell scenario, right? So obviously, this is the conversation that's going on right now. And while advocates, I think, on both sides try to frame it as binary, it's either going to be heaven or hell, there's nothing in between. Obviously, it's probably going to be something in between. But we need to figure out, as a society, as a community, as city, states, metropolitan areas, what do you want the future to look like with autonomous vehicles? The choice is all of ours right now. Because some folks might look at this crazy situation and say, that's hell. That is absolutely hell. Who would ever want to live or navigate something like that? Some folks, though, might look at this, a traffic engineer, and say, this is beautiful. This is a beautiful ballet. This is heaven. This is exactly what it's supposed to look like. No one's getting hurt. Everybody has access. That's a heaven scenario. That's fantastic. So, again, the point here is this is up to every community to decide what you want it to look like. The important thing, then, is that while we do expect massive changes that are the result of this new technology, we have to keep in mind that we've lived through massive transportation changes before. We're now burdened, though, with the knowledge that we had from these previous transportation revolutions, the things that have happened to the economy, the things that have happened to people, particularly low-income people, the things that have happened to the environment, the things that have happened to communities and neighborhoods. So, again, since we know that AVs are definitely coming, we can act now to figure out what kind of community we want to look like. Whether or not you think electric scooters are part of a revolution, we can talk about that, too. So with that as a setup, my remarks are going to focus on these three points. The first thing I'm going to do is talk about the context for autonomous vehicles in America today, just some big picture stuff kind of laying the groundwork for what we're talking about. Then I'll tick through several of the outstanding issues that we still need to deal with from a transportation perspective. The technology is one thing, but there's an enormous set of issues that we haven't really even begun to scratch the surface with yet either. I'll end then with some thoughts on what public policy should look like and some examples for some things and places that are doing things well. Nobody is doing everything right. Nobody has this figured out yet, but places are starting to do that, and there's some really good examples from all across the country. I need to say up front that, kind of as Bob was saying, I'm talking about driverless vehicles here. We're not talking about driverless trains, driverless ships, driverless subways. There's lots and lots of good examples of driverless vehicles, as Bob was pointing out. I'm really going to try to focus just on the vehicle side, not going to touch on drones, things like that. And you also need to know that I'm not a technology guy. So there's a lot of things around the tech that I can basically scratch the surface, but it's really the policy conversation I want to get into. So let me start with the next slide, please, and quickly talk about what does an AV mean? What are we talking about here, just to get us on the same page? So largely, just in very general terms, we're talking about things like sensors and cameras and GPS and lasers that are outfitted on a vehicle in order to help it do some kind of tasks that currently the humans are doing for driving. There's really no autonomous vehicles. We're really talking about the autonomous systems, the parts of the system that are applied to the vehicles that make them do autonomous things. And so I'm going to start just giving you just a very broad overview. These are the levels of automation that the Society of Automotive Engineers has put together. Everybody's pretty much adopted them. I think it's a good way to kind of walk through what we're talking about. One click there, please. The level zero vehicles, or level vehicle automations, where there's no automation. This is just regular cars. It actually also includes basic cruise control, but this is where a human is doing everything in the car. A good example is my 1966 Ford Fairlane. No automation on that car. In fact, we were pushing it most of the time, so it actually had reverse automation. But that's a car, so there's a lot of the vehicles that are on the roads today. Basic stuff, but the human is really responsible for everything. The vehicle isn't doing anything other than what it's being told to do. Next click, please. Level one is where we start to get into things like adaptive cruise control, lane keeping, systems in the car that are helping, they're thinking a little bit, slowing it up, speeding it down if you're in traffic, keeping it centered in lanes, doing those things without the human kind of interacting with it, but telling it that it wants to be doing that stuff. You still have to set it. You still have to be in total control of the vehicle. And these are the kind of systems that are starting to pop up now. Lots of cars have this. Subaru Outbacks. They seem to be a lot of Outbacks around here in the mountains. So that's a good example of a level one vehicle, a level one feature, I mean. Level two capabilities are where the vehicle can do things like manage the speed and manage the steering. But you have to tell the vehicle you want to do it, and you have to be in total control. These are by no means fully self-driving cars. That actually matters. I'll talk about it in just a second. They're available today on lots of luxury car brands, things like Tesla has them, Mercedes, Cadillac has them, and even though they're telling you that this is autonomous vehicles, these really are not quite yet autonomous vehicles, because in all of these cases, all three of these cases, the human still has to monitor the driving environment. That's a really important point. Level 3 and 5 is where we start to get into what we mean by automation. So today, there are no ready market vehicles in levels 3, 4, and 5. So you just have to know that from the start. Level 3 capabilities, what they call conditional automation. Here it's the system, instead of the driver, that's starting to monitor the environment. But the human has to be ready to take over in case something happens. This is related to that crash a few months ago. We could talk about that in just a minute. But that's what's going on here. The human has to be ready to take over with a warning from the car. So the Audi A6, I think, is the new car that has this. They have something called a traffic jam feature. If you're creeping along the road, I think it goes up to 37 miles an hour. Once you get above 37, it has to click off and you have to take over again. It's tricky because when you're going less than 37, you may not be paying attention. Then all of a sudden, you have to start paying attention because you're going really fast. So there's a lot of things we still need to work on. And actually, that Audi feature is not even allowed in the United States right now. So we don't have any of those features today. Level 4 vehicles are totally automated, but only on defined routes or within a certain kind of geographic range, geographic fencing. They really know where the vehicle is. It's not roaming around. It's going on very specific routes. So there are about 10 of these things now. They're called low-speed autonomous vehicles. Those are these little shuttle bus things you can see down there. You might have seen they started one in middle of central Texas somewhere. But there's a bunch of these places around the country, mostly closed routes, mostly doing something very specific, like going back and forth, and they don't deviate from any of that. Level 5, one more click. Level 5 is the peak. This is the stuff maybe we think about, autonomous vehicles driving all around all by themselves. We are not anywhere even close to having anything like this now anywhere at all. That's what we need to understand. There are a lot of folks who are in this field who really want this to happen, say, we may be a generation away, we may be 50 years away, but we're not close to having these right now. It's important to understand that. So in terms then of time to market, you can see how then, because we have that that confusion, this is kind of all over the map as well. So you can see the blue flags are, these are the automobile manufacturers. They're much more optimistic about when we're gonna get these things. They're not very specific all the time about what level we're talking about. None of them are talking about level 5, fully autonomous in this case, but they think that it might be happening, Tesla obviously is out in front, maybe happening in the next 2 or 3 years, some kind of conditional automation starting to hit the streets. Then you start to look at other firms, other tech firms like Uber and Google, then you get to the researchers and the advocates, and there's an enormous disparity between what the researchers and the advocate thinks are gonna happen, and then what these car manufacturers and other folks think are gonna happen. McKinsey thinks that 15% of new cars that are sold in 2030 are gonna be level 5. I'm not sure if that's true. A lot of people may doubt whether we can do it by 2030. But part of the reason for this divergence is that there is no centralized actor right now that's moving all of this stuff in the same direction. It's kind of happening in a very atomized, very kind of diverse, dispersed method, because it's still public and private and nonprofit actors that are kind of developing the automotive industry in ways that were very different than it was 50, 60, 70 years ago. But I think it's because of this atomized, kind of diffused nature that we actually are making a lot of progress. A good example for this is the automated highway. This was, I should say 1991. This was something that I started, that I was working on when I first started way back in those dark days in or early 90s. Congress authorized $650 million for an automated highway system. This was predicated on the idea that there's smart infrastructure embedded in the roadway. That's all the sensors and the gizmos we've been talking about, talking to the smart sensors and the gizmos and everything like that in the vehicles. And so the public sector was gonna have a very, very big role, because they're building the infrastructure, they're putting in the sensors, they're spending all that money and all that work. And as you can see, it worked perfectly. This was an absolute success. And then nothing at all happened after that in terms of the automated vehicle, because again, it required the public sector to make those investments when we didn't have that going on at the time. So that means that the Federal Department of Transportation has had to shift, right? So with the private sector taking the big role, doing all the experimenting, doing a lot of the testing, really being out in front instead of the government doing that. The role of the government then is for question. What is then the Department of Transportation supposed to be doing? They're used to doing things like certifying safety features, a steering wheel or a brake pedal, things like that. It's very, very different when you're starting to certify things like software systems and systems integration. Very, very different role for the federal government. In 2016, the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, known as NHTSA, developed the Federal Automated Vehicles Policy, which was the first step in creating a central federal policy that was starting to govern what we talk about when we think about autonomous vehicles. The policy was written in consultation with industry stakeholders, automakers, tech firms, state governments, officials, experts in the field at a very, very broad reach. But it's neither binding nor is it comprehensive. It's designed to start to get out there and to give the industry some kind of assurance that the federal government is paying attention, that they're doing what they can to try to stimulate that innovation and keep all the good things that are happening going, but trying to provide that framework so that we can have some kind of national standards. We're now at a point right now where no one can certify the vehicles because nobody knows quite, and the industry really can't agree on standards yet. So I'll talk a little bit about the federal stuff here in just a minute. Even Congress is getting involved, and that matters because Congress isn't doing a whole lot right now. So here you have Congress showing a willingness to act. The House has passed something called the Self-Drive Act. The Senate is supposed to be getting ready to get some floor time for AV Start. Those are basically two pieces of legislation designed to provide that framework of what the federal government should be doing when it comes to autonomous vehicles. The AV Start is the one I think that's going to get a lot of attention. They're trying to figure out, well, are they going to be able to move it this year, this summer? There's obviously a lot of crazy things happening in Washington. Maybe they're going to attach this to the aviation bill. Probably, I think what's going to happen is they're going to miss it, and they're going to have to reintroduce the legislation again next year. I hope they get something done. I do think that we need this, but it's not clear if we're going to get it done right now. It would preclude states from passing any laws that would attempt to regulate how self-driving cars perform. That's something called preemption. We'll get to that in just a minute. And the states will then continue to focus on licensing drivers, doing law enforcement, crash investigations, all the things that the state is basically doing right now with vehicles and how people are getting around, but doing it under this different model. So again, the states are then going to have a lot of action when it comes to autonomous vehicles. They really are going to be in the driver's seat. States are they're passing laws, they're doing executive orders, regulatory guidance. A lot of states, in fact, are in competition with one another because they believe if we are friendly and we are accommodating for all the testing that's going on with autonomous vehicles, we'll be able to attract firms that will come to our state. And because it's going to be a big industry, we'll be out in front. I'm not saying that's wrong, but I'm saying a lot of the motivation for this is coming from an economic development standpoint. Colorado is actually the first state to pass this kind of regulation to allow testing. They were able to attract a couple of firms. Easy Mile and a couple of others, I think, are moving to Denver if they haven't already. They have been talking about putting automated vehicle lanes in one of the new highways they're building in suburban Denver. And of course, Uber truck drove the beer truck from Colorado Springs to Fort Collins, something like that. That got a lot of attention. You move beer like that, everybody's going to pay attention. But so states like Colorado really are out in front and are starting to, I think, benefit because there's a lot of action happening here we can talk about. Next slide, please. So the second thing then is, despite all the action that is happening, and there actually is a surprising amount of policy, especially related to other areas of infrastructure, other areas of transportation. But while there's a lot of action happening from a policy perspective, there's still a number of really, really thorny issues that we have to figure out and deal with. For policymakers, a lot of this has to do with things like certification. How do you certify autonomous vehicles and certify that they've met some kind of standards for safety, operations, and all that other kind of stuff? How do you assign liability for things like collisions? And how do you insure against damages in a driverless world? These are really some of the most challenging things that we have just barely begun to deal with. And as you can probably imagine, probably bigger showstoppers or bigger impediments or hurdles than the technology, which is moving on its own pace. Today, those of us who are driving are liable for everything. But experts are suggesting that this risk should shift from the human driver to the software that's developed by the vehicle manufacturer or the technology provider. So a completely different frame for who is responsible for things that go wrong with the vehicles. To be clear, there's no precedent right now for when an autonomous vehicle has been held liable for a crash. I think that's still true. And I apologize for this grisly picture, but this is a crash of the Tesla Model X that crashed in California earlier this year, just a few months ago. This is being investigated right now, but it's a very ugly fight where Tesla's driver, or Tesla says that the driver should have been more alert. The driver's family says, well, the technology was faulty. It's their problem. So we've got to figure all this stuff out. This is one high-profile crash. The vehicles still have been proven to be very safe, but this is probably not going to be the last one. We've got to be able to figure out some of these issues in order to move forward. And states and the federal government, in this case, the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, needs to work together so we don't have 50 different tort laws that we're having to deal with. So we've just really begun to scratch the surface of what the impact is here. The rise in AVs then causes a lot of concerns about malicious attacks on the vehicle and on the driving systems and what could result from such an attack. And I think you had folks here last week talking about cybersecurity and talking about what a giant problem this is going to be in lots of different areas of society, huge issues that are playing out right now with autonomous vehicles. And this slide really amazed me when I saw it in a report from the Government Accountability Office. It shows that as electronic systems have increased, as the vehicles become more technologically savvy, the amount of software code that goes into them is starting to increase literally exponentially. And when you compare it to an F-22 fighter jet or a Boeing airplane, it's far more than both of those vehicles, which I was really, really surprised to see. But as autonomous vehicle stuff becomes more prevalent, it clearly opens up vulnerabilities that need to be addressed. And as folks will tell you in the cyber community, we are not even close to dealing with any of these things right now. There was a big event at the Wilson Center in Washington 2 weeks ago, and that put the fear of God into me. Just listening to the way they're talking about this, we really have to figure this part out right now. In fact, in 2015, there were a couple of white hat hackers, which I had to ask my son what that was. These are hackers that go in and do things and hack into vehicles or hack into systems in order for positive things. He was trying to demonstrate that these vulnerabilities were real and they need to be dealt with. They remotely disabled a Jeep's braking system. It safely got over to the side of the road, but trying to illustrate that this can happen and it's something that we have to deal with right now. Although the manufacturer did address that vulnerability in the Jeep, it's only gonna become a greater danger as these vehicles become much more complex and start to have outside digital connections. This is an area that we just haven't quite figured out right now. And in terms of data, there's a massive amount of data that AVs and autonomous vehicles are already collecting. Today, most new vehicles have things like event data recorders, these little black boxes that provide information about the crash. And current state laws state that the vehicle owner owns the data and only a court order can access that data. But is that going to be the same with autonomous vehicles? Is that going to be the same when it's not the driver who is liable or responsible, but when it's the system that's liable and responsible, and the data that goes into making those decisions? How is that going to change? It's probably going to upend that entire thing. What if it's a shared fleet model? What if it's a vehicle you don't own, but you're subscribing to a mobility service? That's what everybody's promising is going to happen, but we have to deal with these issues around data. What happens to the data that's then generated by the vehicles? It's going to know who you are. It's going to know where you're going. There are things like regional planners. We talked earlier about regional planners and transportation engineers would love some of this data. We get some real information about origins and destinations. You can plan the system better, but the manufacturers and the OEMs obviously don't want to share any of that data with a lot of folks. So data is a really, really big issue that's probably not as sexy as some of the other things, but it's definitely something that we have to deal with in order to move forward. Infrastructure funding. The next thing, we all know that we need to invest much more money in our infrastructure. This issue has been pushed closer to the front burner of the policy discourse. We haven't really done anything, even though it's been pushed to the front burner, mostly because we haven't really found the resources to pay for a lot of the investments we need. We can talk about that in just a minute. But a couple of things here. AVs really need to have very clear striping and very, very clean pavements. They're not gonna be able to really function very well in an environment like this. So public policy leaders, state level, local level, wherever they are, have to make sure that if we're going to accommodate new fleets of autonomous vehicles, we have to have very, very good infrastructure. You have to have clean roads in order for the vehicles to make the right decisions. But if these are fully deployed, we're gonna lose things like parking fees, right? You're not gonna need to park your car the same way. If we meet that promise of the vehicle living somewhere else, driving around, It's a huge amount of money that goes to municipal coffers from parking fees and fines and things like that. If that goes away, it's less money for infrastructure, et cetera, et cetera. And if we have electric vehicles, they're not going to be consuming gas, they're not paying gasoline tax, and that's another way that we're losing a lot of money that way as well. So where does the money then come from in order to accommodate autonomous vehicles in the future? A lot of things could be upended that change that model very dramatically. Next thing is around the workforce. Today, we're actually experiencing a huge problem with workers in the transportation space, particularly commercial truck drivers, where we have a lot more jobs that can be filled right now, having a very hard time attracting people to those jobs. I think you can make the case that, well, with the promise of autonomous vehicles, you can make those trips a little bit easier. Maybe you're not doing autonomous vehicles or autonomous trucks the whole way, but if you leave a port and you're driving it, you get an I-80, you click it into autonomous mode, and you can go for much further, and then when you get to San Francisco, you go back into manual mode. But there is a big concern about what automation means for lots of different areas of the economy, but particularly for drivers. There's about 4 million jobs right now in the United States that are quote-unquote drivers. And truck driving is the most common job in 29 states, and it's 2 and 3 in pretty much everything else. So it's an awful lot of people in this country right now that are dependent on this for their daily livelihood. It's unclear about what all this means. I don't know if it's going to mean that we're going to have a lot of people that all of a sudden without that kind of work. Driving is only part of the job. As I said, maybe there's ways that you can figure out how to have people do the autonomous part and the driving part at the same time. We'll have to figure that out. We have this perpetual truck driver shortage. And again, I think the technology might be far enough away where we're not going to be able to affect this conversation today. But what the workforce of the future looks like with automation is something we also haven't addressed yet either. And then research. We have autonomous vehicles in a lot of long-range plans from localities and regions. We have university programs that are focused on this. We have a lot of testing that is going on, mostly in private kind of situations, kind of closed-loop things. But we need to get beyond tests like this, which I think we've already done a very good job with these level 4 vehicles. We know that we can get these things to work. The technology on these is really, really good. In a closed system, it's very predictable. It knows where it's going. And frankly, I've ridden one of these. It's boring. It's really, really boring. It doesn't do anything special. It does exactly what you think it's going to do. But we need to start branching out from these closed systems and run these vehicles in different kind of urban environments because the conditions in these environments is obviously very different than it is in the real world. The last thing in this piece I want to talk about then is consumer acceptance. While the discussion, this whole conversation actually might be moot if people don't even want to get into these vehicles to begin with. And there was a recent study that just came out, and maybe go back and look, and none of these studies are connected to each other, so we can't really say what's happening over time because there's different questions and different answers. But you can look at these polling results trying to figure out consumers' attitudes towards autonomous vehicles. Do you like them? Would you ride in them? Would you be comfortable? Somewhat very. And we've gone from 44% about a year ago to 21% a new Brookings study that came out last week or 2 weeks ago. So something is starting to change. It may be the hype curve that Walt was talking about at the beginning. It may be the result of those crashes, which got a lot of attention and clearly are devastating things we need to talk about. But something does seem to be changing with consumers' attitudes towards autonomous vehicles. And I'm actually very curious. A show of hands, who would be comfortable riding in an autonomous vehicle today? And not what he was talking about with the airport stuff. I mean, one of these guys. It's pretty good. So I've asked the question. It seems to be about the same level that folks have. People aren't sure. We don't really know yet. But I think consumer acceptance is going to be a big deal here in the future. So let me then just end, before my voice goes out, with a policy conversation. And so what does all this mean? So we know what the technology looks like. We have a good sense of what's happening. We have a good sense, I think, of what the big challenges are and these really big intractable issues. So how should public policy then respond? All these issues around certification, liability, cybersecurity, environmental issues, this is all very, very complex and very, very complicated. Let me just start then by saying I think that the states are still going to have to do the lion's share of the lifting. I'll get to that in just a second. But the federal government cannot abdicate responsibility for at least setting that big framework so that we don't have a big patchwork of rules and regulations all across the country. The federal government is still going to have to be heavily involved in certain areas, things like safety, things like anything related to interstate commerce. This is why the federal government and the Transportation Department exists in the first place, and the harmonization of those policies across states. You really don't want to have these situations where adjacent states have different rules and you can't run vehicles back and forth. They want to bring an autonomous vehicle from California to the Consumer Electronics Show in Nevada last January, and they had to stop at the border and change the license plate because they had different license plates in two different states. You got to be able to get beyond that kind of specific rules and harmonize it across the board so you can allow things to grow and things to flourish. The big issues, I think, on the federal level is going to be that issue of preemption we talked about. How can the federal government preempt the states and localities from crafting their own AV policies and rules and regulations, or is it going to be something else? And then what about data? I think data is something we really want the federal government to have a big role because of where they are, because of their stature, and they can harmonize things and make data standard and uniform. And as a researcher, you know, we always want more data. So that's one thing. In terms of the states, as I said, I think the states are going to be in the driver's seat. This is happening in a lot of different areas. We see the federal government devolving a lot of responsibility down to the states. But in this one, it probably makes a lot of sense. They're going to have to pass comprehensive regulations under that federal umbrella. And as you saw from the map earlier, a lot of states are starting to do this. There's a little bit of an arms race that's happening with the competition between them. But they've long been responsible for regulating things like tort and liability and insurance, and they're going to have to keep doing that for roadway vehicles and for autonomous vehicles. It may change that conversation. It may be that we have to relook at all those things and figure out, well, what does it look like in the future? But the states are going to have to be responsible for it. I also think they're probably going to have to take the lead on these workforce initiatives again, especially proactively implementing things like career development programs and starting to get in front of some of the concerns that folks have right now for the loss of drivers that may come in the future. There are transit agencies around the country that are thinking about this right now. The AV shuttle that they're testing in Texas is actually planning to not have to have a driver in the future. So this is something that it may be a long way off, but we've got to start dealing with it right now because it's a big problem today. And then they also have to start investing in just something like a state of good repair. It's kind of boring. It's kind of mundane. It's not the most exciting thing. It's just refilling potholes and things like that. But it's got to be something where the states have to step up because that's the role that the states have. They also then have to get in front of some of the problems that we're facing with the declining sources. There's not going to be a gas tax in the same way. There's not going to be other charges in the same way. Some states are starting to experiment and putting things in place today, like Tennessee has an autonomous vehicle miles charge. It's going to charge vehicles based on when and where they're traveling. It has a very modest, I think it's a penny a mile, something like that. And that money's going to go into investing in a state of good repair. It's a fantastic policy because nobody has it yet, so nobody can complain, right? So Tennessee was very smart that way. Massachusetts and another couple other places are doing, but that's the kind of stuff that the states are going to have to be responsible for, and they're paying a lot of attention to this right now. Next slide, please. The last thing then is for the localities and figuring out what do local communities then do. This all seems, I think, very large, very ephemeral, or that's the federal government dealing with something, it's too high up, or maybe the states have something to do with it. But a lot of this is going to land, and a lot of the concerns we've seen around the country are from localities like this one that's wondering, well, what is the impact going to be on this community in the future if this technology or some version of it does come to fruition? How is that going to change how we get around? How is that going to change the built environment? How is that going to change how we interact with one another? And that certainly is something that we do need to pay attention to. And the localities are going to be in charge of a lot of that. The first thing they're going to have to do is to ensure social equity on all this, making sure that all segments of society benefit. I'm not saying we'll have to equalize and everybody's going to get a car. The first versions of these vehicles are definitely going to be super premium, really, really expensive. The auto manufacturers aren't even pretending. They're aiming for something on the high end. But maybe you can do things like you can provide transit service, you can figure out ways that everybody is benefiting from the technology instead of just those who can afford super premium products. They also then need to do robust data sharing and things like that, not just who's ever setting the rules, maybe it's on the federal level, but the states then should be really sharing that data back and forth, working with private firms to negotiate agreements about data sharing. And I can tell you, we've been working with a lot of these folks right now. This is an enormous issue because the private firms, for good reason, do not want to share the data they think is proprietary or that one of their competitors may be able to get an advantage over. So the localities are going to have to figure this one out because we need some of that data. We need to figure out what we don't know. The last thing then is to plan for tomorrow today. Things like scenario planning. As we go around the country, there does seem to be a lot of concern from folks who look at the hell scenario right now and are waiting for level 5 autonomous vehicles to come in and then disrupt what it's going to disrupt. What we're trying to get folks to do is to understand you can start to do things today. If you're worried about things like what's going to mean for parking, you can pass parking minimums today that affect that into the future. If you're worried about what is it going to mean for the sharing of curb space, if vehicles are dropping people off all over the place, you can put those in place today. If you're worried about lane width, all these things, there's an awful lot that localities can start to do now by having that conversation in their communities, talking about, well, what are people concerned about? What are they most excited about? How is it going to look, and how can we preserve what we want to preserve here in light of some of these disruptions? All that can happen right now. It doesn't have to wait for the ultimate goal. So technology has always been an agent of change, especially in transportation. We've seen it in transportation over and over and over again. It happens very, very regularly. But over the next decade, I do think that AV technology is going to change rapidly the landscape for transportation. I do think that innovative and measured action is necessary right now in order to set the groundwork for the future. I don't think we have a really good sense of what it's going to look like yet, but I think it's for each community to decide what it wants the future to look like. So I want to thank you all very much for having me here. I want to thank you for listening. I look forward to the questions.
So I think most of you know the drill with questions. So I get to ask the first question, which I'll label the local question. Having been now in Steamboat for about 24 hours, and understanding a bit about our landscape, our terrain, our ranching, mining, and recreational enterprises, do you envision autonomous vehicles to be a viable, all-weather, all-purpose possibility in an environment like ours?
Weather is actually a good word to use there, because the initial reaction, and you've seen a lot of other resort communities, is folks planning for those level 4 vehicles, those shuttles. Especially in places like this, you have shuttles running all around. You can imagine a closed route system that thing is happening from an automated standpoint, and that would be great. The weather is the big issue. Those level 4 vehicles, I think right now, don't do very well even in rain. I can't imagine what it would do in a situation like this, but the snow and the terrain, I think they'll get there on that, but they're not there right now.
This is an interesting question. Do you see a day where vehicles with a driver will be prohibited in metropolitan areas?
I will say no, only because I think I do think that we are more than a generation away from completely driverless vehicles. I think then that in metropolitan areas, there's still going to be a need for vehicles that are driven. It may be in certain communities or certain neighborhoods. I just don't think that we're there right now where everything is going to be autonomous. A lot of the speculators and a lot of folks who are looking at us and probably saying the same thing, that we're just not quite there yet. I'm not saying it's never going to happen. It's just hard for me to envision right now.
This is a very specific but important question. Can you tell the audience what is LiDAR technology and how is it used in the vehicles?
I can tell you what I know a little bit about it, but it's a system where it's scanning the environment and then feeding that back into the system. It's laser based. I meant to look this up before I came down here. But it's what a lot of the AVs are using to monitor the driving environment around them, looking at the conditions and vehicles and things like that.
Do you see a possibility that government, federal, state, or local, could declare an emergency and take control of all autonomous vehicles? The big brother question.
Yeah, I don't. I could see why that would be a concern. Again, when we think about the large cybersecurity issues, this does come up. I think the governments are having challenges right now just dealing with their own business. Imagine doing something like this seems to be a bit of a jump for right now. And I think if it got to that point, that would be the technology would be so ubiquitous and mainstreamed that I think the general public would have something to say about it. All that said, I think we are facing some big issues around cybersecurity. And I don't think, when I listen to the folks who are concerned about it, not from a transportation standpoint, but from a domestic terrorism standpoint, things like that, it actually does raise some issues that I don't think we're ready to deal with right yet.
And a related question. Do you think or do you see the possibility that police would have the ability to deactivate power on an autonomous vehicle?
That they would do it?
Delete the power, cut the power. I assume that these are all going to be electric vehicles.
Yeah, I don't know. I know that the capability probably exists today. We know that there are vulnerabilities. I think that the police probably would like that ability to do that. I have not seen that conversation happening in some places. It actually is an interesting point. We've been doing work in the state of Virginia, and it was the first place where they actually brought in the police for the meetings we were in. They actually brought them into this conversation of transportation planners and engineers and all those they actually brought in law enforcement. And I can tell you, it was a very, very different conversation talking to law enforcement than it was talking to the transportation planners. These are the things that the police are very concerned about.
I'll label this the trade-off question. Given the high costs and limited resources that go into the production and development of autonomous vehicles, do you think that urban planners would be better off using their resources to improve mass transit and urban planning solutions, as opposed to putting resources into autonomous vehicles?
Yeah, this is a great question. This is a very live conversation happening in a lot of places. I was in Miami, and they heard me say something, and the first reaction was, well, maybe we don't need them to build our new rail extension, this $5, $6 billion project they were doing. And they were almost relieved. This was something they didn't want to build, and this was almost the excuse that they had to not have to build it. My reaction then was, well, you don't have to build it if you don't want to. You can do what you want to do as a community. But they were ready to buy into a lot of the hype that this is happening today. There's a lot of things that mass transit can do that autonomous vehicles are never going to be able to do. And you can move an awful lot of people, especially in the near term, very efficiently and effectively on mass transit. That said, there are a lot of places around the country where transit ridership is declining precipitously, particularly in middle-sized metropolitan areas. Not the big places, D.C., New York, Los Angeles, but a lot of other places. We're seeing transit ridership decline. So these places are actually experiencing some fiscal challenges. If there's a way that autonomous vehicles can help mitigate some of those challenges, I think they would welcome that right now.
In order for a city like Steamboat Springs to be ready for autonomous vehicles, it's a two-part question, what additional infrastructure would be needed, and what would be the net additional cost to the community?
That's exactly the right question to ask. I do not have the answer to the latter part. Colorado actually is, as I said, is very far out in front, and so I think the state probably has a big role here to play, especially around the testing, which is still what's happening right now. And as I mentioned, we're really trying to, what the auto manufacturers are looking for and the autonomous vehicle firms is clean paper. That's really what they want the most. In fact, a lot of the reason they're doing testing in Virginia right now is they've just built a whole bunch of new hot lanes like you have here in metropolitan Denver, these high occupancy toll lanes that are brand new, they're really clean, and they're great for vehicles. So the infrastructure question is to fix the infrastructure so it is as clean and readable as possible to an autonomous vehicle. How much that's going to cost, I have no idea. Roads seem pretty good here, but I think they're looking for something much better.
Do you think we will get autonomous trains sooner than cars as they are driven on a track?
I do. I think that there's especially metropolitan metro systems, subway systems. We have it around the world, have it in the airport.
Sure.
We had it in Washington, and then we went back. We'll get it back in Washington. So I think it's going to be much more prevalent in those situations. For the freight rail companies, I think so. I think they're already trying to figure out how they can, especially moving very, very long distance hauls across the continent, they could probably do that more efficiently with less folks in the locomotive. I don't know if they're ready to do that quite yet, but I think the technology is probably going to be there sooner than in than for vehicles.
Is the interstate highway system an opportunity for early adoption of AVs?
That's a good question. I don't know if it's the infrastructure itself. As I said, the big leap that we had is when the infrastructure just had to be normal and be clean and clear, and it was the vehicles that and the systems in the vehicles that were being smarter. So I don't know if that if the system itself that's going to be the opportunity. But as I said, I do think there's also an opportunity in trucking, and so especially for long distance routes. As I said, if you could leave a congested area and then get on a long stretch of interstate, that seems like a natural place for testing and for operating autonomous trucks. So where that happens on the interstate, that's probably it's probably going to happen there. But I don't think because it's the interstate, it's going to make it much of a difference.
So that's a perfect segue to this next question. What do you see as the likely entry timetable for autonomous trucking versus Amazon-type delivery to local delivery points, individual homes and businesses? Mm-hmm.
Any questions about predictions? I'm so bad at that part. The trucking is happening now. I mean, they're experimenting with lots of different things, truck platooning, things like that. I think the industry would welcome that because, as I said, there's already a driver shortage. There's a lot of efficiencies that can be gained. They're doing just-in-time delivery right now, and so they're really squeezing it very closely. So I do think that trucking is an early adopter. When? It's very hard for me to tell you. Maybe. I think some of these technologies we're going to have in 5 to 10 years. I don't think we're going to have fully self-autonomous trucks driving on the interstates anytime soon.
Insurance companies seem to be silent so far when it comes to AVs. What do you see for their participation or the demands of insurers?
Yeah, that's a really good question. Something that I'm definitely not as well-versed in, but I will say while they may be silent right now, they are certainly at the table, and they have very clear perspectives on a lot of this stuff, but they're keeping their cards, I think, close to the vest right now. I've seen a couple of insurance companies that are maybe starting to figure out maybe there's a market here, a niche that we can tap into. I haven't seen a lot of action happening right now, I think because we're just not there with the technology.
Are AVs on the rise in other countries, and is the USA currently a leader or a follower in this technology and with related policies?
It's a great question. I would say that we're a leader for sure, both in terms of the tech. Germany is also a leader. There are a couple of other places, but the US and Germany do seem to stand out. From a policy perspective, I don't think anybody's really doing it great so far. But because we have the state role, because the states have been doing what they're doing, I'd say we're out in front because of what's happening there.
How can AVs accommodate to changes? For example, you're in the middle of a trip, and all of a sudden you encounter an icing situation, snow, detours, etc. How adaptable will AVs be to those types of unplanned and unexpected changes?
The promise is that they would be completely adaptable and perfectly responsive to those changes. That's the promise from the manufacturers and proponents of AVs. This is really a threshold question. If it's not going to work in all situations, it's almost useless. I mean, it has to be able to be adapted to things like that. And I think some of the reason that folks think we're looking at a generation in the future is we haven't quite nailed those issues right now. There's ethical things that we can talk about, but a lot of the tech around unpredictability I think still needs a lot of work.
Thanks to all of you for your great questions and the Rob for tonight. Thank you very much.
This has been a special presentation of Seminars at Steamboat. You can find the extended question and answer session on our website, kunc.org. Join us next Sunday evening at 8 for the final installment of this summer's Seminars at Steamboat. The radio broadcast was produced by Ryan Thompson for KUNC. Special thanks to Bob Stein, Jenny Lay, the Steamboat pilot and today, and the staff of the Strings Music Pavilion for their support. Music by Scott Holmes. Find information on future seminars at seminars@steamboat.org. This is KUNC.
This is KUNC 91.5 Greeley, Fort Collins.
KVNC 90.9 Minturn Vale.
KRNC 88.5 Steamboat Springs.
KENC 90.7 Estes Park.
And KMPB 90.7 Breckenridge.